From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Now here's your host, Mark Kepler.
The 2018 midterms may see the biggest voter turnout in a generation. What are the propositions and races driving voters to the polls?
This November, California voters will have their say on several ballot propositions and initiatives. What are the implications for California? We'll ask John Myers with the LA Times and Laurel Rosenhall with CalMatters.
Additional funding for the Matty Report made possible by a grant from the wonderful company, harvesting health and happiness around the world, as well as support from Era Energy LLC, Bonner Family Foundation, Community Medical Centers, Harris Ranch Inn and Restaurant, Nossaman LLC, Sagasser Watkins and Whelan, and Valley Children's Hospital. From the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Matty Institute, it's the Matty Report with Executive Director of the Matty Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome, I'm Mark Kepler with the Matty Institute. Well, the November ballot's going to be asking Californians to weigh in on a number of public policy issues. We're fortunate to have two well-respected observers of state politics to explain the what and the why behind the November's propositions. We have Laurel Rosenhall, the covers capital California politics for Cal Matters, and John Myers, the Sacramento Bureau Chief with the LA Times. Welcome.
Thank you.
Laurel, sorry for mangling that there in the beginning. I apologize. Affordable housing. Big issue in California. Number of props on the state ballot. For example, we've got Prop 1, a $4 billion bond for affordable housing. We've got the Prop 2, the $2 billion initiative for permanent housing aimed at the chronically homeless and the mentally ill. Are either one of these a game changer?
Not a game changer, but a major infusion of, you know, one-time cash. So they would help a lot in terms of building new housing, but it's not going to...
The need is huge.
I was just going to say, it's not going to take care of the entire need.
Yeah, what do you think?
Well, consider one of the numbers out of this, Mark. In a lot of years, the state roughly builds about 100,000 new homes. It needs to build double that number. And the bond measures that we're sitting here talking about, they're certainly helpful for veterans. They're helpful for lower income Californians. They don't help middle class Californians. And they don't help, I think, the systemic problems that you see in Southern California, in the Bay Area. It's not enough. I mean, everybody's going to say something is better than nothing. The question is, what else could we do? Should we be doing?
Yeah, kind of driving the bucket. I was looking at the numbers, and they're saying that the backlog by 2025, we need to build 1.8 million homes to cover the backlog. And if you want to satisfy demand, lower prices, you got to add another 1.7 million. So we're talking, I'm not sure my math is right, 3.5 million new homes by 2025. That's a lot of new homes.
Well, and not only that, but you look at any given year, you just haven't done what you need in the year, and then you look at what the candidates for governor, like I'm reminded of numbers that were like 300,000, 500,000 a year. That hasn't been done in any year in modern California history.
You know, in 2012, John, Governor Brown nixed these things called local redevelopment agencies, RDAs, and about $1 billion of that money, he was trying to save because of the budget constraints, of RDA funds was going to affordable housing. Is Prop 1 and 2, are they an attempt to kind of get back to that?
I don't think so. One, because they're limited. They're veterans, low-income Californians. The money probably won't get distributed statewide in the way redevelopment agencies existed. And then keep in mind, too, redevelopment agencies went away in part because they had a lousy track record in a lot of places for actually building housing versus using money for other things. In some instances, only about a fifth of the money actually went to housing versus development.
Well, there were some anecdotes that were just really problematic. What do you think if we see these props fail? Are we going to see another attempt to create a kind of an RDA 2.0?
I think you're going to see that either way. Okay. Assemblyman David Chu has already said that he plans to bring it back, and the only stumbling block for him has been Jerry Brown, who doesn't want to do it. So next year with a new governor, I absolutely expect that'll come back.
Yeah, I want to jump over to Prop 10, which is a law that repeals restrictions on cities and counties from enacting rent control measures. Are the arguments that it's going to save or devastate the housing market really overstated? What do you think, Laurel?
I think that there's a lot of hyperbole in all of these propositions, and that one, you know, included. You know, it is There's a lot of studies that show that the impacts of rent control are very hurtful on the local housing markets. At the same time, there are persuasive arguments from people who are in cities without rent control, who are seeing their rents go up and up and up, mm-hmm. and who are really begging for some kind of relief.
What do you think, John?
I think the hardest part about Prop 10 is that it is simply releasing the restrictions on rent control. It doesn't mandate rent control will happen. It doesn't change anything guaranteed in any community in California. And there are these economic push points about that people will no longer rent these places if they are limited on what they can make on it. Mm-hmm. But I think to Laurel's point exactly, people say lots of things in campaigns. This would be one step, but it's a small step and it's not a guaranteed step. And lawmakers in Sacramento ultimately have to come up with a
That's a really important point. It's local control issue. Eventually, if it does pass. Let me ask you one last question, John. CEQA, California Environmental Quality Act, a lot of people, certainly Republicans, point to that law as really hurting the ability to build more housing. You think there's going to be an attempt, regardless of what happens on these propositions, to amend CEQA?
It's been talked about a lot. Governor Brown, who of course will be leaving office shortly, has said there was never a CEQA exemption that he didn't like. But doing it is a tricky thing, and the reason it hasn't been done, I think, in part, is because there are environmentalists who believe you don't throw all of this out. You don't completely gut this law that actually makes people take a second look at the environmental impact of things. I think that CEQA is a ballot measure waiting to happen. The question is there money behind construction groups, business groups to move it forward or not? I don't know, but it's got to go to the ballot.
There's a prediction for 2020. Well, up next, a water prop is on tap. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. We're talking with Laurel Rosenhall with Cal Matters and John Myers with the LA Times. Water is one of those perennial California public policy issues. We're at it again, Laurel. So Prop 3, the Water Supply and Quality Act of 2018, would authorize about $9 billion in bonds for a wide variety of specifically detailed water projects. Given that it follows Prop 1 and 2, are voters going to have bond fatigue when they hit Prop 3?
I would say it's possible, but not likely. Generally, the pattern has been that voters approve bonds and are okay with borrowing money if they like the purpose. On the other hand, we did just have a water bond a few months ago on the June ballot, and so depending on how tuned in they are, that may be a factor.
What do you think?
I don't know. I think if there's ever a test to see if voters won't support a bond measure, it could be Prop 3. It could be simply because of the points that Laurel just stated. Also, too, you look at the ballot analysis. We're talking about something that will cost over time $17 billion, about $8 billion in bonds, but $17 billion to pay it all off with interest. They were very smart, the backers of Prop 3, in getting a lot of buy-in from a lot of groups, ag and environmentalists and conservation people. There is no formal opposition to Prop 3.
But this follows other water bonds. Yeah. We had a water bond in June,
right?
And we had one in 2014. The one in June was $4 billion. The one in 14 was $7.5 billion.
And the proponent of Prop 3 has even said that this is almost like where the 2014 measure that Governor Brown supported, Prop 1, left off, that it's that kind of projects. I think people will say that the water supply is important in California, that the mechanics, the needs are real. Whether this is the right one remains to be seen, but voters do not have problems with bonds. To Laurel's point, they just say, hey, that's fine, let's do it.
Let's fill the reservoir, which Laurel aims me to my next question, that is on water supply. It's in the title, the Water Supply and Quality Act of 2018, but only about $2 billion, less than a quarter of the money, actually goes to increasing the supply of water. Despite that, Prop 3 has the backing of agribusiness. Why is ag accepting not even half, but really a quarter of a loaf?
Because $2 billion is $2 billion more than zero. Okay. I mean, honestly, I just think that, in order to get something that was going to be politically viable, they needed that broad coalition that John described. You need to have environmentalists on board. It can't be an ag-only deal. And so everyone kind of who's supporting it is getting some of the projects that they think are best for the state.
And so does this mean the water wars are solved?
No, I don't think so. No, of course not. We wouldn't be that crazy to say this. But let's not forget, to your point about agribusiness, Mark, everybody wins if California has more water. And like, look at Prop 3. It has water conservation, ways to make sure that we're not wasting water, recycling issues. I mean, so my point is, It doesn't change the system of water, but if there's more water in existing rules, if you're the agribusiness community, maybe you think that's a pretty good deal, that therefore, you know, it helps you in the long run.
Well, some of the opponents, John, saying that this is really a pay-to-play situation, that some special interests are receiving special funding guarantees. They specifically point to the $750 million of the $1.2 billion to repair a canal is going to a specific canal, the 152-mile Kern-Fryant Canal in the Valley. Proponents, though, on the other side would say, listen, water is vital to California's infrastructure. It's vital to ag that feeds the nation. They also argue that the reason why we're in this predicament is because of government regulations, lack of surface storage being built. That caused the overdraft in groundwater, and that caused subsidence. What do you think the voters are going to think?
I don't know. It depends on whether the voters dig down that deep, I guess, is the question. But, you know, the idea that there are special carve-outs and exemptions for people. That's true, but they're the people who backed it. They're the people who gathered the signatures. They're the people who put up the money to do it. And that is the direct democracy system in California. I would also point out that one of the reasons people do that is because initiatives are a lot harder to change than measures that are put on the ballot by the legislature. They can go back in and tinker their public hearings. You get pretty much what you want if you go raise $3 million and gather signatures and get it on the ballot.
Well, let me ask you, Laurel, kind of going to that point. The Prop 3 opponents would argue that unlike the June water bond, this water bond was not vetted by the legislature, but rather kind of crafted in secret. Do they have a point, or is this a distinction really without a difference? I mean, lobbying and that kind of stuff happens with legislation too.
Sure.
Backroom deals.
I would say it's a distinction with a small difference. You know, there are clearly you know, lobbyists who work the Capitol and make backroom deals with the legislators. There's no surprise about that. On the other hand, the process in the legislature is going to allow for those who are engaged to, you know, have the means to be represented in the state capitol to kind of get the updates along the way and push for little amendments and little tweaks and a few more dollars here and a few less dollars there. And so because there's a little bit more of a process, you know, there is more opportunity to have some input as opposed to something that gets on the ballot. Once it's qualified for the ballot, that's it. Can't be tinkered or changed at all.
And it comes, I know you've done some work on this in this area in terms of lobbying and whatnot in the state legislature. Do you see this as a distinction without a difference?
I think everybody says that when they're not at the table, right? Everyone complains until they get their moment in that. And when you see who these people are, if you're not one of them, you get unhappy. But again, there's very little formal opposition to these bonds, and
right.
We haven't seen campaigns on these bonds. And I would think if you had a concern about it, you would run a campaign in some way to point
right.
that out.
Right. There's no opposition with any money at this point.
Well,
I mean, Sierra Club is against it and some newspaper editorial boards, but there's no money
right.
campaign.
Well, up next, we're going to talk about one of those contentious propositions. That's Prop 6 on the ballot. Up next, when this discussion of the Maddie Report continues. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. Perhaps no proposition on November ballot has generated more interest than Prop 6, the effort to repeal SB 1, the 12-cent gas tax, among other things. Our guests are Laurel Rosenhall with CalMatters and John Myers with LA Times. So, John, although generally characterized as a repeal of the state's new fuel taxes and vehicle fees, there's an important aspect of this proposition that may be being overlooked, and that is it would require voter approval of any future fuel and vehicle-related taxes and fees. What are the implications of that?
Well, the implications simply are that the legislature won't be able to take action in the way it has in the past, and certainly won't be able to do what it did in increasing gas taxes in 2017, which is what this is all about. It really, to me, Mark, it's the sweetener of this, right? I mean, it's the thing, you know, voters love to vote
they
in the state on ballot measures. And any idea
particularly on budget matters.
Right. Well, budgets, taxes, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime you tell them you're going to get to have a say at that, that is what I think was designed to try to kind of boost that turnout. The polling hasn't shown it so far. I think they're struggling to get their message out. But I think clearly that was aimed at trying to get a yes vote that much more so.
Is it that ballot box budgeting issue again, Laurel? So what do you think? Pretty important implications if that thing passes?
Yeah, and I think that, you know, cities and local governments are terrified about this idea. And part of the problem is that, you know, this gas tax known as SB1 is really focused on maintaining the roads, really unglamorous kinds of projects, filling potholes, doing kind of some basic maintenance.
And it's a basic government function.
Correct. But if you are now tasked with going to the voters to ask for money, then usually you're going to want to peddle something shiny and new. And how are you going to sell voters on the idea of, you know, we've just got to pave the roads?
Well, let me ask you this. A lot of people seem to acknowledge that this proposition, Prop 6, is really about energizing the Republican base, getting them out to vote, and particularly in those contested congressional races mm-hmm. in California. Will it be enough to overcome the Trump factor in California?
That was the goal. I'm not sure it's going to pan out, honestly. You know, the recent polling doesn't look encouraging. In competitive districts, only a little over a third of likely voters said they plan to vote yes on this. Now, you know, there's still another month to go, but the yes campaign doesn't have a huge amount of money, and I'm not sure in the end that'll be a huge game changer.
I think one of the most fascinating things out of this to me is that it's somewhat counterintuitive what you have to do as a voter here, because mm-hmm. if you don't like the gas tax, you have to vote yes.
Right.
If you like the gas tax, you have to vote no. And that's not the normal messaging you get in a campaign. It's like, no gas tax, but yes,
vote yes.
on Prop 6. So I think that is struggling there too. And honestly, they just don't have the money. I mean, all of the construction industry, the building industry, organized labor, the governor's backers, business groups are all in it for the gas tax to exist as it does. The backers of the repeal have not had money after those congressional candidates put the money in. It's a really tough race.
I think it's going to be a fracture there in the Republican Party between the business interests who want SB1 to stay in place and the anti-tax groups that want to get rid of it. I mean, isn't that crazy?
Absolutely.
I think so. I mean, and the business groups have backed a lot of Republican politics in the past. You wonder if there's an after effect to all
this.
Well,
I think this is part of kind of a bigger evolution we're seeing with business groups in California. You know, they're no longer wedded to the Republican Party. You know, they have put a lot of money into fostering a cohort of moderate Democrats in the state legislature, right. and they have seen that the way to kind of get their policies across is to convince Democrats. So I don't see, I see this whole dynamic as kind of part of that bigger evolution
for
business.
Let's flip it. What about the Democratic Party? You got a situation there where typically they don't like regressive taxes mm-hmm. like a sales tax. Why haven't we heard more opposition from, you know, progressives and Democrats, you know, saying, you know, we don't want the gas tax either?
I mean, some people are saying that. It's not that no one's saying it, but generally you have just an enormous broad range of constituencies that want this thing, including, you know, construction unions and many of the trades, that this is going to be a ton of jobs.
I think that's right. And I think also, too, the backlog is real. There have been years and years.
Anybody who drives knows that.
Yeah, the backlog is real. And there really is no other way to do it. There simply hasn't been. You know, the opposition to the gas tax has said, well, you could use money from this pot or that pot or redirect this. But those are really complicated, very hard to do. I think the Democrats in the Capitol knew this was really the only thing to do. And even if they didn't love it, regressive tax is a really good point. They held their nose and went for it. And so we're going to see in November where the voters are.
Let me ask you this. Governor Brown's sitting on $15 million in campaign war chest. We don't know if he's going to run again for something, but let's assume he's not. Is he going to use some of that money to
not
help?
A chance.
Really?
Not a chance. I don't think so. Now, it's a bold prediction, right? I'll see if I'm wrong by the time voters see this show. I don't think he does, because I think that's his seed money to play in politics after he leaves in the end of the year. I don't think Jerry Brown's going away. I think Jerry Brown wants to remain a force. I would also point out to people that on the 2020 ballot, we think we're going to see another fight over his parole changes, which he really cared about in 2016, Prop 57. He could want to come back and campaign to that. They have plenty of money to try to protect the gas tax in this campaign. I don't think Jerry Brown's
going to
make
it unanimous?
I was going to give a softer no. I was going to say basically.
I went out there. That's right.
I was going to basically say only if he has to. I mean, if kind of like the polls start changing a lot, or, you know, someone comes in with a huge amount of money for the other side and circumstances really change, maybe he throws in a couple $1 million. But right now, there's no reason he would.
We're going to know shortly. All right. Well, up next, what are some of the other props that voters are going to be asked to decide? The remaining props on the November ballot in a moment. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Mattie Institute. We're talking to Laurel Rosenhall with Cal Matters and John Myers of the LA Times. So, John, Prop 5 would amend the state constitution to give older and severely disabled homeowners a tax break. Do you think it is going to have any effect on the split roll proposal that's likely to appear in the 2020 ballot?
Well, it's certainly in that universe of how Prop 13 and property taxes work, right? I mean,
you might want to define split roll for our audience.
Yeah. Well, first of all, you're right. It depends on how long people want to watch this, right? I mean, you go back to 1978. We know how we got Prop 13. We know the limitations it places on property tax payments. This particular measure, though, Mark, before we get to split roll, this particular measure simply extends a process that works in some counties where older Californians can affect effectively take their property tax rate with them when they move to a new house. Split roll, which of course is the big daddy of them all, right, is the one to change commercial property valuations policy so that you would reevaluate them earlier. You'd pay more in taxes in commercial properties versus personal. I don't know. how much people will drill into that on this one. I don't know if they'll understand this one. The realtors put this one on the ballot. I just hate to say I don't know.
What do you think, Laurel?
Well, the thing here is that the realtors have put a second measure on the 2020 ballot, which is very similar to this one that we have this November. And so basically, if this one fails, then in 2020, there will be two Prop 13 related measures on the ballot, kind of moving in different directions. So I think it impacts the calculus, the political calculus for the supporters of split roll, in that they may wind up sort of facing their enemies very directly on the ballot in 2020 with these two conflicting things. But again, that's several chess moves away.
I think the fascinating question for me is, what do the realtors want? You know, I think the realtors wanted, quite frankly, a legislative deal in Sacramento in 2018. Mm-hmm, yeah. They didn't get it. They got this on the ballot. Mm-hmm. It's there where it is. Laurel's right. They've got one teed up for 2020. They could pull that back. There's still time mm-hmm. that they could pull that off the ballot. What do they want? Where are they involved in this mighty split-roll property tax war that we are shaping up for 2020? I think it's going to be super interesting.
And it's going to be a big one. You know, Prop 7 is another one we wanted to talk about, and that was the legislature would provide the legislature the ability to provide permanent daylight savings time if the federal government allows. A timely topic or a waste of time? I know, probably too clever, but...
You know...
Let me check my watch.
Yeah. Right.
The real answer on this one is that I think Brown said it in his signing message. It just allows a very circuitous path to actually making any changes. There would be numerous political and bureaucratic steps along the way.
A great signing message, by the way.
So, right, yes.
Right.
Ending
Let there
with
be light.
Fiat Lux. Yes, exactly. So... So I think that this is one that is like a talker, but doesn't really have a big policy impact.
Quickly, what do you think?
It does nothing. It really does. I mean, it always sets the stage possibly for something in the future, also known as it does nothing.
Okay, so John, let's talk about, there's a bunch of other propositions on the ballot, but not as many as we've seen in the past. Does that mean some of the legislative reforms that we've seen in the past, like redistricting, longer term limits in one house, two primary system, top two primary, is it having an effect? Things are getting done in the legislature. We don't have to go to the propositions.
I don't know if I could be that rosy completely. I mean, I think that those changes in 2014 have had an impact. We've seen it in a couple of places, right? We saw it in 2016. There was a minimum wage measure that was going to be on the November ballot. The sides got together. The governor and the legislature raised the minimum wage. The system worked there. It certainly worked in 2018 when a San Francisco real estate developer came forward with this sweeping privacy measure. He got it on the ballot. The legislature moved in what? A matter of days, mm-hmm. it was knocked off the ballot. It does work in some places. It doesn't work in others. And I'll give you two really quickly that are on this November ballot that show that. Prop 8, Prop 11. Prop 8 is about kidney dialysis centers. Mm-hmm. They would have loved to have had a deal on unionization of workers and wages and cost. They didn't get it. They went to the ballot. Prop 11 is about ambulance employees and rest breaks. They also wanted something in the legislature. It didn't happen. They went to the ballot. The ballot is still the court of last resort.
What do you think, Laurel?
Well, I would just point out as a side note that, you know, there's one more in addition to three that were removed because of deals in the legislature, that three initiatives that would have otherwise been on this ballot. There's one that was removed by the courts, you know, and that
splitting the state.
Exactly. Yeah. So that was kind of, you know.
Maybe next time.
Yeah, that doesn't speak to the efficacy of the legislature, but it does go to show you that there are a lot of different forces at play.
Okay. Well, I want to thank Laurel Rosenthal with Cal Matters, John Myers with the LA Times for joining us.
The views and opinions expressed in the Matter Report are those of the individuals participating in the program and do not necessarily reflect those of the California Channel or the Maddie Institute. If you'd like to share your thoughts about the points and opinions expressed in the Maddie Report, visit our website at maddieinstitute.org.
You're listening to the Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition, on KMJ.
Who follows Governor Jerry Brown as he completes his historic second 8-year stint as California governor will be decided this November. In addition, legislative seats up for grabs could alter the look of the California legislature as well as California's congressional delegation. We'll discuss the upcoming November races with Laurel Rosenthal of Cal Matters and John Myers of the LA Times.
Additional funding for the Maddie Report made possible by a grant from The Wonderful Company, harvesting health and happiness around the world. From the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Maddie Institute, it's the Maddie Report, with Executive Director of the Maddie Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. Well, we're going to have a new governor, a new state legislature, potentially a new Congress after November elections. How consequential will all that be? We've got two important people to kind of guide us through this, John Myers, who's the Sacramento Bureau Chief for the LA Times, and Laura Rosenthal with Cal Matters. Welcome to the Matter Report.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, John, President Trump seems to be looming large over everything. What effect is he going to have on Californian voters in November?
It really is the question, mm-hmm. isn't it? Trying to figure out the Trump effect, for better or for worse. The one number that I keep looking at is what is the president's job approval rating in California? When you look at one of the recent polls from the Public Policy Institute, it's about 37% of likely voters supported the job he's doing. I kind of consider that the base number, right, for a lot of things. Base number for John Cox, who's running for governor. Base number for Republican candidates in battleground districts. Base number for the gas tax, which you would think there'd be some kind of linkage between mm-hmm. people who would be like-minded. I don't know, but that's a low number. And if you see anybody else hovering near that number, it shows you they're not appealing to someone else. You've got to appeal to more than the Trump electorate in California, I think, in most cases.
I'm going to try to argue the contrary. Non-factor or factor?
Oh, definitely a factor. Okay. I mean, I looked at the same poll, and the number I took away was that, you know, half of likely voters think this race is more important than any other, you know, recent midterm election. And so you've got a very energized, especially on the Democratic side, very energized electorate who is fired up and believes this election is really, really important.
And he's approaching almost 60% negatives in terms of his overall performance, President Trump, in California. So that's probably another issue. Well, let me ask you this. So we've got the Kavanaugh Supreme Court nomination. We've got the Me Too movement. What impact are those things you think are going to have on California congressional races?
I think that this was already kind of shaping up to be a bit of a year of the woman even before the Kavanaugh nomination. There are a record number of women running for office this year, something like one-third of the candidates across all the races in California, one-third of the candidates this November are women. And while that's nowhere near the numbers that women make up in society, it's more than we've seen on the ballot in 20 years. So, you know, it was already kind of shaping up in that direction. I do think that the Kavanaugh nomination process was extremely motivating for a lot of women, and so I think it's an example of kind of how your vote really plays out. You saw women kind of making an impact on Senator Jeff Flake face to face, you know, in terms of the decision to delay the vote on his nomination, and you saw the impact that, you know, one swing vote can have in the Senate. So those things really do show the you can't win if you don't play. And so they do kind of give, I think, an energizing feel for the importance of being involved.
I will go back to that poll if I can really quickly, Mark, for one more number. Prior to the whole biggest part of the Kavanaugh fight, that poll of Californians, 74% of likely voters
That's
said
right.
that the Supreme mm-hmm. Court decision was important to them this year. I bet that number could go even higher after what we saw with the Kavanaugh situation. You've got to think there's an impact on
election day. Voters are paying attention. Well, John, what about the economy? It seems doing pretty well, fairly robust, but it doesn't seem to be benefiting Republican candidates. Why is that?
Depends on who you talk to. I mean, the question is, do you hear Republican candidates talking about the economy? I mean, look at those battleground House races. You know, when you look at them, a lot of the conversation is about Trump. A lot of the conversation is about illegal immigration. It's not about jobs and the economy and the impact of the tax cuts. And so we've all heard, you know, now for 25 years since the Bill Clinton campaign said it's the economy stupid, except that it wasn't this time. It's immigration stupid, or it's Trump view, or it's something
well, Trump
else.
Trump seems to drown out the other messages.
There's a lot of noise,
Yeah, what do you think?
Oh, I just think, you know, positive news is a little bit taking a back seat right now, you know. Mm-hmm. So, yes, things are humming along well in terms of the big picture of the economy. But there is a lot of drama coming out of Washington, and it's very hard for any political campaign, try as they might, to kind of ignore that.
You know, it's going to be interesting. Voter turnout is always an interesting issue. And typically, Latinos don't vote in the numbers that probably would suggest that they would, young people, women. Mm-hmm. Are we going to see a big change in voter turnout, you think, in this election?
You know, the turnout in the primary this year was much higher than last time around. So if that holds, then yes, we will see high turnout. Now, high turnout in California is a relative term because we generally don't have good turnout. But I do expect that it would be, you know, I don't know, between 50 and 60% this time.
It'll be a key indicator of kind of what's going on here. I mean, it was better than the last election, but the last elections were, especially the last 2014, was the worst in California history. So it really had very few places to go but up. But we have been waiting for a very long time, to your part, Mark, for voters of color, younger voters, to show up with the same enthusiasm they had there. Look at the 2016 race. They were enthused about Bernie Sanders, for example. Bernie Sanders didn't win California. So you can't win unless you show up to vote. Registration is one thing. Casting the ballot is the thing.
Okay. Well, up next, we're going to talk about the state races, the governor, the state legislature, and those often overlooked constitutional offices. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. We're talking about this November's races with John Myers of the LA Times and Lowell Rosenhall with Cal Matters. So, John, what state issues do you think are going to be motivating voters as they're thinking about the next governor or the next legislator?
Well, it's interesting. You said state issues because I was going to say all these things that are national issues until you said that, because I do think it's a nationalized election in a lot of ways. Having said that, you look at the polling. I think illegal immigration is still up there. I think it has been put on the table nationally. It's being talked about in the state. I will be curious to see if people talk, at least on state races, about housing, about homelessness, about transportation woes, and that's outside of the gas tax debate of Prop 6, because those are the things that impact life in California. Jobs and the economy important, but housing is that thing that we've spent the last couple of years in Sacramento talking about. Do we hear about it on the campaign trail?
What do you think, Laurel?
I just think, as far as for voters, you know, the cost of living in California is paramount. It's, you know, if you're doing well and you own a business, you're worried about sort of the tremendous cost of running a business and attracting and retaining your workers. If you are a worker, you're worried about
where
the basics,
you
know, paying the rent, paying the bills. So I think the cost of living is a big deal. And I think, you know, we've seen on the campaign trail, certainly John Cox, the Republican candidate for governor, is trying to make that a marquee issue. And Gavin Newsom, in his own way, is doing the same thing, sort of with a different spin on it. Right. But he's, you know, saying that, yeah, our economic inequality, the cost of living here, it's really hard.
Well, the expectation is, frankly, that Gavin Newsom is in the lead. All the polls show that. So what is going to be the fate of Governor Brown's big legacy projects, the high-speed rail, the Twin Tunnels project, if Newsom wins?
You know, I asked him that question last year at the State of the State, Jerry Brown's last State of the State, and he said he was going to be continuing the vision if he had the
One tunnel, half the vision. One tunnel instead of two.
So he said one tunnel instead of two, but, you know, and he's flip-flopped on high-speed rail, but his, you know, current kind of position is he would be continuing Brown's vision on both of those things. I think overall, you know, for Gavin Newsom, if he becomes the governor, the challenge is going to be how much does he work on sort of continuing Brown's legacy versus how much does he work on differentiating himself and establishing his own legacy? And I think it's going to be a difficult line to walk and one that we will see him trying to kind of straddle over the course of his governorship.
If he's like any governor, he has to come in and put his brand, his stamp on something. And maybe he wants to take a second look at those projects and look at the fine points of the tunnel project or high-speed rail. He certainly talked about accountability on high-speed rail a little bit. He can't say, I'm going to do something completely different because that would be something we would write about, right? So he's going to say, you know, I believe in them, but I think he should take a look at them, and he probably will.
You're seeing the polling showing that actually the Republican John Cox is kind of narrowing the gap with Gavin Newsom. Enough to win?
Enough to win. Again, I go back to my Donald Trump job performance number, which was about 37% in a poll. There was a poll at one point in the governor's race a few weeks ago, 39% for John Cox. He was basically getting the Trump vote. He doesn't have the money that Newsom has. He is playing in a state where Republicans are vastly outnumbered. They are fewer than 1 in 4 registered voters at this point. It's an uphill battle. Never say never in politics. You don't know what the very end is going to be, but it's hard to see a path forward unless there's an unforced error from Newsom.
Okay, so let me ask you about some of the down-ticket races, Laurel. People don't really pay attention to. Any ones that kind of you're looking at that these are kind of interesting?
I mean, the state superintendent of schools is going to be a very fascinating, high-energy, big-money race. It's considered a nonpartisan race, but really what you have here are two Democrats with very different visions about public education. And this is one of the issues.
What's the critical issue there? What are they...
Charter schools and sort of employment conditions for teachers are enormous. And, you know, Marshall Tuck is the candidate who's backed by the charter school and the world that kind of calls themselves the school reform world, education reform. Tony Thurmond is an assemblyman who is backed by the teachers union and the more sort of establishment of the education world. And education is one of the few issues that really divides Democrats. And so this race kind of exemplifies that larger schism within the Democratic Party.
Lieutenant governor, not because the lieutenant governor has anything to do,
governor
but
Light.
Because it's a, you know, get up in the morning, see if the governor's okay, go back to bed, right? But because I think both of these candidates have their eyes set on some other office, Eleni Kounoulakis and Ed Hernandez, both Democrats, I think they both think they could see themselves in a race beyond this. Kounoulakis, of course, has not served in California, was an ambassador, her big coming out. And insurance commissioner, Steve Poizner, who shed his Republican label to become a no-party preference candidate to come back
to
be insurance
commissioner. Which is very interesting. Is he setting a new strategy for Republicans?
Well, against Ricardo Lara, a Democrat, well-known Democrat from the state Senate, whether Poizner is really a different guy depends on who you talk to. I've talked to him. I didn't really see a big change other than some immigration issues. I think some people see this as a test of being a no-party preference candidate. I think this is a Steve Poizner. Does he come back and rehabilitate his issue after a blistering gubernatorial race in 2010?
We're really out of time, but I want to ask you a quick question, John, about the state legislature. Are we going to see the Democrats retake a supermajority in the Senate?
I think it's going to be hard. There's like one or two races we're watching. I think it's a toss-up.
What do you think?
I think they'll get it in the Assembly, and I think the Senate is more the question.
Okay. Well, up next, we're going to talk about the U.S. Senate race with Dianne Feinstein. Is her approach of bipartisan, agreeing, working with folks, still work in the age of Trump? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. U.S. Senator Dianne Feinstein was first elected U.S. Senator in California in 1992, 26 years ago. Some would say in very different times. Can this experienced bipartisan dealmaker fit in the age of Trump? We're talking to Laurel Rosenhall from Cal Matters and John Myers of the LA Times. So, John, Senator Feinstein's challenger, State Senator Kevin DeLeon, has indicated that Senator Feinstein's really out of touch with today's California voters. She's just too moderate. What do you think?
I think it mirrors the fight in the Democratic Party. It mirrors, and frankly, it mirrors the fight in politics now about ultra-liberal, ultra-conservative, who can be pragmatic, is there a value, is there a reward in being pragmatic? It's fascinating, isn't it, that Dianne Feinstein came into office in the U.S. Senate in the aftermath of the Anita Hill, Clarence Thomas hearings, right? And here we are in the aftermath of the Brett Kavanaugh, Christine Blasey Ford hearings. I think it really depends on who votes. And it really depends on whether people see Feinstein as as getting somewhere, or do they want to make a broader statement? De Leon's had an uphill battle this whole time. I think it still is an uphill battle.
It closed the gap, but there's still a gap there.
Well, he got his party's endorsement, which was an enormous coup to, get the endorsement over the incumbent. He has endorsements from some powerful labor groups.
He doesn't have the money.
But his background's in labor, too.
Yes. And even, he has the support of Tom Steyer, who has billions of dollars, but doesn't seem to be spending them to help him.
Hasn't given it to him, right.
So, I think that he has a very powerful, but perhaps in the end, symbolic run.
Yeah, he's a guy, and I just have to say really quickly, Kevin DeLeon, who's been in Sacramento for a very long time, author of landmark legislation
Absolutely.
On climate change, on immigration, but is not known.
And you've got to effective leader of the Senate.
Right, but you've got to have money when your name idea is not out there in this state, and the money just hasn't been.
As I recall, he lost in his very own district. He lost for this race in his own Los Angeles district.
Well, what do you think, Laurel, in terms of the Kavanaugh matter, the Me Too movement, is that going to help or hurt Dianne Feinstein?
Well, I think it helps her among Democrats. It hurts her among Republicans. But Republicans don't like her anyway. Republicans are going to probably mostly sit out this race anyway. They're going to skip it on their ballot. I think for Democrats, it shows that, having a senator with a lot of seniority puts you sort of in the center of the action.
Let me ask you this. John, she's had some hawkish views on immigration, certainly in the 1990s. She's evolved from that. But Dan Walters, another person that's been on our program several times, has suggested this might cut into her lead among, the anti-Trump, pro-immigrant Democrats. Do you agree?
It might, but I think what Laurel said is right, is that there are going to be a large number of people, I suspect, who skip this race, who don't either don't know enough, don't see enough of a difference on the issues, Republicans, independents. Mm-hmm. And so then it really comes down to the people who cast the vote on this. And are they going to punish her for that? I have a hard time seeing that it actually comes to fruition. I do think with a different race, with a candidate who's well-funded and a different message, Feinstein would be feeling the heat more than she's feeling it now. She seems to be, we said at the beginning here, someone who speaks to a politics that has not that has moved away in some ways, about pragmatism and centrist. And this race could have been a lot different if De Leon had had the momentum.
Well, here's a tough issue, Laura. I'm going to throw it at you. Senator Feinstein is going to be 85. Is 85 oldest member of the U.S. Senate. If reelected, she'll be 90 at the end of her next term. Appears to be in good health. Other senators have been in the U.S. Senate into their 90s. Will this be an issue? Should it be an issue?
It may be an issue for some voters, but I don't think it'll be an issue for enough voters that it's the deciding factor.
Don't think so. You know, I'm thinking Alan Cranston. For some reason, I'm thinking there's similarities here. One of the things that was being discussed when he was running was maybe he's too old, et cetera. Is that an issue in this race?
People talked about it at the beginning. They talked about it quietly because they realized this was a very difficult thing to talk about, and there's a backlash to talking about it.
They use code words like, you know, a new generation or a new leadership.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think the polling has been pretty consistent that Feinstein has, she has not lost or gained a lot of ground. De Leon has gained a little bit of ground. I still think it's her race to lose. I don't think that's going to come up.
Yeah, she's an icon in California politics, that's for sure. Well, up next, the congressional races in California, they could flip the House to the Democrats. Is that possible or even probable? That conversation in a moment. This is Mark Kepler with the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. For the Democrats to win back the House, they're going to need to win some seats in California currently held by Republicans. What are the chances that will happen, and what does it mean for California if it does happen? We're talking to John Myers of the LA Times and Laura Rosenhall with Cal Matters. So, John, how many races in California, congressional races, are really competitive?
Depending on how you define it, somewhere between 6 and 8. And really, you look at these Republican seats where Hillary Clinton won for president in 2016. So you've got them, and they're really clustered around Southern California with some in the Central Valley. Of course, you've got those in Orange County. You've got the Central Valley, David Valadao, Jeff Denham. That's where Democrats have put their money in this. They believe that their momentum is on their side. I don't think they think they can win all of them, but if they can win half of them or something like that, that is a major road toward taking back the House.
What do you think, Laurel? Agree, 6 to 8 is what we're really talking about here?
Yeah, I mean, some people might go as high as 10, sure, depending if you include like the McClintock district in, you know, Northern Sierras or not. But, I mean, yeah.
It seems like a good number. I've seen that number as well. I just wanted to double check, and so you verified that. Laura, let me ask you this. It seems like the congressional Republican strategy in California is just kind of to forget Trump and to paint congressional Democrats as just kind of tax happy, you know, spending politicians. And they've seized on Prop 6, which is the repeal of the gas tax, and hoping that's going to kind of energize their base. But that's a state issue, not a federal issue. Is that strategy, you think, going to succeed? Will it overcome the Trump effect?
I think it may work in some districts. You know, it may motivate Republicans in some districts. I don't know that it kind of sweeps the state as this strong force, particularly because that campaign for Prop 6, they're lagging in money and they're going up against some very well-funded interests that oppose the thing. But fundamentally, like so many things in politics, this is going to come down to turnout. You know, who comes out to vote? That is going to be that's going to be the deciding factor.
And we talked, the very first question in this program was about what effect is Trump going to have? And you said he's going to have a really big effect.
Yeah, and it's so fascinating that when you look at some of these congressional races, in the cycles before these, and I'm thinking mainly 2012, 2014, 2016, they were so nationalized, and those Republicans were running about Obamacare is horrible and all of these, you know, and now, to that point about the gas tax, we're trying to pivot it some way and get away. Don't look at the national show in a way. Let's talk about, you know, these horrible tax projects in California. It's a fascinating pivot in part because of Trump. They can't distance themselves, these Republican incumbents, completely, because that would get them in trouble in Washington, but they can't embrace the guy completely. It's a really tough place to be.
So Trump, as a general rule, in these moderate swing districts, is going to be a bit of an anchor for Republican candidates.
Could be. And I don't know that I call the districts moderate, but I'd say the electorates are really polarized here. And the question is, if you get turnout, if you get high Democratic turnout in some of these races, that's a real, real problem.
So, John, I'm going to ask you to kind of stick your neck out here a little bit, make an educated guess. How many seats do the Democrats win in California? How many do they take away from the Republican, if any?
It's easier for me to come up with a number than to tell you district by district, right, in which case I would be in trouble. I think a reasonable number is 3 or 4. I feel like that the hopes are always higher than they're really going to be. I can't tell you which ones those are, although I would say watch Southern California races more than the Valley races. The Valley races, you know well, you have not seen things pay off there in a way. So I'd say maybe 3 or 4.
What do you think, Laurel?
I was going to say about 2 or 3. So
we're close. Yeah.
Okay.
But similarly, Orange County, Northern San Diego County, that seems to be the real swinging area.
Yeah. Right. So let me ask you this, Laurel. If the Democrats do win control of the House of Representatives, what does that mean for California?
I think it means that there is going to be a lot more pressure on the House on the issue of impeachment. I mean, I think you're going to have a lot of Californians who are going to be really pressuring their members of Congress on impeachment.
I think you're going to have some of the most liberal members of the California delegation are going to be in the spotlight, and maybe not in the best way, because the national narrative about whether an impeachment vote helps Democrats in 2020 is very different than California. Look at Barbara Lee in the Bay Area. Right. Look at Maxine Waters in Los Angeles. These are people who are going to be very vocal probably about impeachment. And they may not do exactly what Nancy Pelosi, if she is the speaker, would want in terms of that positioning for 2020. I think Californians are going to be in the spotlight no matter what.
Well, is California going to be hurt in some ways because, you know, Kevin McCarthy, it looks like he's in line possibly to be the next head of the House, good relationship with Trump. All of a sudden, he's now in the minority. Does that hurt California?
I don't know. I mean, how's the McCarthy relationship with Trump worked out for California so far? I haven't really seen any demonstrable impact.
Other than, you know, the disaster aid that California has gotten very quickly from the Trump administration, that may or may not have something to do with Kevin McCarthy. I don't know. You can't really say that McCarthy is sending home tons of pork for the entire state of California. So
I guess it remains to be seen.
But I will say a safe prediction, a Californian is poised to be the next Speaker
exactly.
of the House.
Well, there you go.
That's Nancy Pelosi, Kevin McCarthy.
That's right. Thank you, John Mars, LA Times, and Laurel Rosenthal with Cal Matters for joining us. Now it's your turn to exercise your Democratic right and vote. This is Mark Kepler for the Matter Report. Thanks for joining us.
The views and opinions expressed in the Matter Report are those of the individuals participating in the program and do not necessarily reflect those of the California Channel or the Maddie Institute. If you'd like to share your thoughts about the points and opinions expressed in the Matter Report, visit our website at maddieinstitute.org.
The Matty Report, Valley Views Edition, is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio, Cumulus Media, and the nonpartisan Matty Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on politics and important public policy issues. This is KMJ.